And turning to the book of Genesis, chapter 37, and verses 1 and 2. Genesis 37, verses 1 and 2. And Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah, and with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. And our subject is the shaping of Joseph. Now, this is, to most of you, I'm sure, a very familiar passage. The events that we read of in chapter 37. People don't read chapter 38 so much, but they're just as important. And then on through the history of Joseph. And the history of Joseph extends from Genesis 37 to Genesis chapter 50. It is a remarkable thing, and it's been observed many, many times, that in modern, and using a modern analogy, it's as though the Lord puts the brakes on when it comes to Genesis 37 and slows down to a crawl the mighty vehicle of Holy Scripture, and begins to look slowly, deliberately, and in detail at each feature of the life of Joseph. And of course, the first thing you ask is why? Why so much detail for Joseph? After all, Joseph wasn't even in the line of Christ. It would be through Judah that the seed royal was conveyed, not through Joseph. And Joseph was, for much of his life, an exile from his people. And yet the spotlight is going to fall on Joseph. It is increasingly obvious as we study the history of Joseph, in that he is undoubtedly a type of Christ and the work of Christ as deliverer. Now, it's not very popular to say that these days, because if you look at the majority of study Bibles and Bible dictionaries, anything modern, anything issued in the last 20, 30 years, it's likely it will not even mention the possibility that Joseph is a type of Christ. And if it does, it'll do so with great reservations. Some teach that kind of introduction to just a passing comment. It's an extraordinary thing. If you read anything older than 40 or 50 years, it's the universal conclusion that Joseph is a type of Christ. Of course, he isn't identified as such in the New Testament, and most of the types are identified in the New Testament, but it is so overwhelmingly obvious that it is the case, as is the reason why he's given so much attention in these chapters in the book of Genesis. But we'll come to that as time goes on. And we're just going to look at one and maybe one and a half chapters and look at some features of the shaping of Joseph. And Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger. The past tense is not intended there with regard to the father, because actually Isaac is still alive. In chapter 35, previously, and the last two verses of the chapter, the death of Isaac has been recorded, but not in chronological position, because when you come to chapter 37, Isaac, has 12 years to live. So Joseph has his father, Jacob, and his grandfather, Isaac, in the house. They're all there. And Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father, Isaac, currently was a stranger or a sojourner. That is to say, they were moving about like nomads. At the moment, they're in Hebron, but they move from time to time, all their flocks and herds and their very many servants and so on. They're almost a minor kingdom, but there his presence in the land of Canaan is once again recorded. And then we go straight in to the life of Joseph. Verse 2, these are the generations of Jacob, Joseph being 17 years old. He's the second to youngest. his younger brother, Benjamin, is a long way younger. He is really quite minor here. And Joseph is effectively the youngest. And all his brothers are much older than he is. And it's important to bear that in mind. Because, when you look at a very familiar narrative in the Bible, in the Old Testament, which is how I feel anyway, you frequently come to it and you think, well, I'm very familiar with this passage. And yet always, when you read it carefully and reverently, you see some things that you didn't grasp before. And I'm sure it's so with all of us. So it's very important to look at this chapter with a spirit of great expectation for something you may not have observed or noticed. And in verse 2 of chapter 37, we see that Joseph is 17 and he's feeding the flock with his brethren. It's very significant which ones. The lad was with the sons of Bilhah and with the sons of Zilpah, the two maids who were assumed as wives to Jacob. Not Jacob's true wives, but the maid servants. So these are the lowliest of the sons. And we know who they are. There's Dan and Naphtali and Gad and Asher, four of them. And they're the ones with the least status. And I call attention to this because they are the sons to whom Joseph was sent in order to learn how to be a shepherd. He wasn't assigned to the oldest sons, to the sons of Leah and Rachel, but to the sons of the servants. So it is nonsense to say that Jacob was spoiling Joseph. When he puts him out to apprenticeship or to training, he puts him out to the lowest rank of son in the society of those days. There's no fast passage to supremacy or anything of that sort for Joseph, and it's worth noting that. And at the end of verse 2, Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. The way the Hebrew is constructed, it looks very much as though this evil report was put together by somebody else, or it was their awful reputation in the neighbourhood, in the region. And Joseph simply relates it to his father. And immediately some writers pounce. Here is this spoilt boy. We're going to see how much, how greatly loved he was by his father and given more attention than all the other older brothers. And here he is telling tales very unwisely. He's the goody-goody and making himself thoroughly unpopular. Dear friends, don't think like that. That's all superficial observation. We're talking here about the church. This is not just the family of Abraham. This is the church of ancient times. And I sincerely hope that if any of you who were church members knew of anything scandalous being perpetrated by another church member, you'd remonstrate with them and you'd make it known. It's your absolute biblical duty to do so. You're the church of Jesus Christ. And so we shouldn't look at Joseph as though he's acting out of line and he's talking behind the backs of his brothers. He's certainly not doing that. He's reporting their bad reputation and their conduct and all the trouble they're bringing upon the family and how they're ruining the entire testimony and spiritual and religious stand of the family in the region. He's a duty to make that known, and he knows perfectly well he's going to suffer for doing this, because when Jacob is obliged to chastise them and take them to task, as he surely will, it is Joseph who will be hated for it. So he's doing something very costly and very courageous, and something which is it is his absolute duty to do. But sometimes people can be so silly. They can assume that this is just some minor prank that somebody has carried out. And so a too goody-goody lad is reporting everything in order to gain favour for himself. That's a quite ridiculous analysis and evaluation of what is happening. So I thought I'd mention that. But anyway, Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. What they were doing, whatever it was isn't mentioned, was evidently evil. It was shocking. It was awful. And it was discrediting the family and the witness and the word of God, and it had to be reported. But now in verse 3, Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colours. Just consider this, dear friends. Once again, the tut-tutting begins. How unwise of Jacob, how foolish of him to show favouritism and love. And he created this situation, and he spoiled the boys, and the other brothers had some grounds to be antagonized on account of Joseph. But if you look at verse 3 carefully, you'll see, now Israel loved Joseph. In verse 1, he's Jacob. In verse 2, he's Jacob. In verse 3, he's Israel. He is suddenly given his official name as a prince with God, and as the representative of God, and as the bearer of the promised seed, and as the one to whom God has appeared in several theophanies and appearances. He's given his official name. Now that is a principle of interpretation. If you stop saying Jacob and you suddenly say Israel, you are not going to read any criticism of him. You can be sure that what is reported when he's so named is something good, not something bad. His official, divinely given name is in use. That's common sense. That's hardly the most elaborate principle of interpretation. So it would be superficial to begin, as some do, to criticize Jacob for showing undue affection to Joseph. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children. And I'll tell you one of the reasons, because he was still only a boy, and the others were big enough and ugly enough to take care of themselves. They were adults, and isn't that natural and normal? If you've got a lot of children, and there's one who's 35, and there's one who's 30, and there's one who's 28, and all the rest of it, and they're great big strapping adults, and you get a little fellow come into the family, it's natural and wholesome and right and proper that the parents are going to love the child more than they love the brutes, the adults. That's totally natural. And the adults should not be jealous of that affection. They too should be especially warm towards the child, and especially protective, and especially endeared to them. That's totally natural. It's quite ridiculous to say, foolish Jacob, wrong Jacob, getting it all wrong. Well, it would be wrong if they were all 17 or 18, and they should be treated equally, and there shouldn't be a favourite singled out. But under these circumstances, the others were experienced shepherds by now. They were adults looking after their own family units and so on. So set aside all the nonsense of blame that Joseph was a telltale, Jacob had undue parental affection and favouritism towards one. That's all nonsense, dear friends. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. It tells you he's the youngster among them. And he made him a coat of many colours. I think the King James Version is right in this coat of many colours, though there is a reasonable dispute about it. It could be indicating that it was a coat with long sleeves and leggings attached to it, possibly. But whichever, it was a coat of honour. And all that tells you about Joseph is probably that he was a very bright lad, and so he had an honourable garment given to him. Jacob felt that he was destined for great things. But the brothers should never have been jealous of that. This only illustrates to us their unpleasantness. They're not nice men, these brothers. They have no generosity of spirit. They have nothing in their hearts for Joseph. They're so proud and self-seeking themselves, they resent the affection he's getting as a teenager. They're bitter, they're petty, they turn out to be exceedingly cruel, they're dishonest, they set out to hurt and belittle him and eventually to murder him. What a bunch! What a crowd they were! They're pretty awful people as the record unfolds, the brothers. And so, of course, our modern minds, always looking for a cause. Isn't it strange? Even Reformed Christians who believe in the depravity of human beings are always looking for some reason why somebody's bad. It's never their fault. There must have been a cause. It's somehow we don't like the idea, no, they were just bad. It was their fault. That's what they were like. They had tremendous advantages. They had a godly father, a godly grandfather, a tradition of biblical training, wonderful evidences of the power of God, and yet they turned out bad. Why? Because they were bad. There were some things that didn't help. Jacob's earlier polygamy didn't help, I agree there. There was rivalry in the family always, but you can't blame it all onto that. And you certainly can't blame, I won't go into this again, but the nonsense idea that Joseph was a telltale and the father was too fond of the boy. That doesn't make somebody a monster and murderous and so on. These brothers were no good, and it was their fault. And that's, the Bible is frank about that. You can have the best background imaginable, and you can turn out to be an absolute rotter. It can happen. Probably they didn't like separation from the world because they were sinful brothers and they wanted to be in the world. They didn't like to have to live with Isaac and Jacob in tents apart from society generally. They didn't like all the devotions and all the reading of the ancient scriptures and things of that sort. Verse 4, when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him. But it was an unreasonable hatred. They should have joined in the love for Joseph and could not speak peaceably unto him day after day. What a credit to Joseph. He maintained his piety even though he had their rough tongues to contend with and their jibes and their insults constantly. They never could say anything pleasant to him. But it didn't make him sour or ill-tempered, or to give up his belief in the things of God. And matters get worse in verse 5. Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. And he said unto them, hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed. Well, you know it. They're binding sheaves in a field, and his sheaves arises, and the other sheaves bow down to it, his. And that infuriates the brothers. How do you imagine he told this dream? Well, you know, it's clearly an oracle. It isn't just a boy's idle dream. A teenager, perhaps a bit too vain. Now his own vanity's got him and he's dreaming dreams of superiority. And he can't keep his mouth shut about it, even though it'll make him unpopular. You read all that in some of the books. No, there is a tradition of divine oracles in the family. This has happened to his father Jacob several times. This is in the passed down knowledge of the family, going right back to Abraham's revelations, visions, communications from God, appearances. Joseph knows when he has an oracle from the living God, and he thinks about it. What does it mean? What can it mean? Maybe he guessed some of it, that one day there's going to be a famine and somehow God will use him to be the means of delivering the others? Maybe he got it right and understood it to some extent. Can't be sure of that. We don't know. But anyway, the dream was that they would all be grateful to him. Now, I believe that Joseph would have told this with great humility and in such a way that it should not have aroused their fury and their anger. But all they could see in this dream was dominion. He's going to have dominion over us. They live for dominion, those brothers. Their pride and their place and their being significant. This was the way they thought. They were not nice fellows. And so it infuriated them. And they were even more angry with him. Joseph probably knew they would be furious. And this is how they would take it. But he was a spiritual young man. And if you have an oracle from God, you have to speak it, like the preacher, like any Christian engaged in personal witness. No matter how you put it, you know sometimes people are going to be very angry with you, but you've got a duty to tenderly and sensitively speak for the Lord. So you do. And this was the burden which was upon Joseph. No, he wasn't a silly fellow who was saying something he should have kept to himself. It was an oracle of God. And then in verse 9, he dreams yet another dream. Only two are recorded, but the plurals in the language suggest that there were actually other dreams, only two of which we're let into. And he dreamed yet another dream and told it his brethren and said, and he told it his father this time, he couldn't tell it to his mother Rachel because she was now dead. Behold, I have dreamed a dream more. And behold, the sun and the moon, this is a kind of authority dream, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars, that's the brothers, made obeisance to me. And he told it to his father and to his brethren. And his father rebuked him. And the Hebrew word for rebuked is related to the word scream, which means his father very strongly rebuked him. His father didn't like the sound of this, Jacob, at all, but he thought about it. And he changed his view. What is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother... Why does he mention the mother? The mother was dead. Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee, to the earth? Well, he mentions Rachel because she's in the dream too, Joseph's mother. And although she's dead, Jacob obviously takes it as symbolizing the whole family. There's no quarrel about whether Rachel is alive or dead. It represents the whole family because she's featured. Shall we bow ourselves down? But in verse 11, his father observed the saying. And the Hebrew word translated observed means he hedged it about. Literally, it's the hedging word. He protected it. He preserved it. It was a special statement. And although he'd at first, his first reaction was to rebuke Joseph, on reflection he obviously realized this was a communication from God, it was an oracle, and he must watch to the future because Joseph would be in some way the family deliverer. And he thought about it, and he treasured it, and protected it. And even the brethren, the brothers, their attitude seems a little different because they envied him. And that's right, the Hebrew is they were jealous of him. So have they been affected perhaps by Jacob's respect for the dream? And they don't like it at all and they don't want it, but they're jealous of him. Perhaps jealous of him having his father's respect in the matter. But I must hasten on, because in verse 12, his brethren went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. Very strange place for them to go. They'd fled from Shechem. You remember the massacre brought about by the brothers in Shechem over Hiram? And they were afraid of the inhabitants of the land, the Hittites and the Canaanites. And it was only because God put a fear on the people that they were able to flee the land and get out of it without being attacked and possibly destroyed. So what are they doing with their sheep going back into dangerous territory? Well, the only answer one can think of is that there was a localized drought in the area of Hebron. And so they had to go back down into Shechem, where there was grassland and so on. And this would tie in where they went, and 50 miles to go, just 25 miles further was the Dothan area, and they find this pit into which they can drop Joseph, and it's dry. So it all suggests that there's been a scarcity of water, and they're roaming round to save their flocks. Perhaps that's what's behind it. But they're going into dangerous territory, and that's the point. And so Israel, his official name now used, verse 13, is worried about them. He's anxious about them. And so he commissions 17-year-old Joseph to follow them and to bring word of their safety. And Joseph's happy to go, though he's hated by them. Whether he's aware his life could be in danger, I don't know. But both the father and the son ought to be aware that there's danger in this. But it's a mission of care. The brothers ought to be grateful. The younger brother they despise has been sent by their father to make sure they're all right, to take back word, to see if anything is needed. It's a mission of kindness, a mission of care. But when they know he's coming, and they see him afar, how quickly they plot his death. And the details are recorded in verse 14. Go and see if it's well with your brothers and with the flocks. And in verse 15, he's found looking for them in Shechem by somebody who happens to know they've moved on to Dothan. And so Joseph goes on to Dothan also. And verse 18, when they saw him afar off, even before he came near unto them, a plot was never hatched so quickly. They see afar the coat of many colours, the gait of their younger brother, and they conspire against him to kill him in those minutes. That's the hatred in their hearts. What an opportunity we've got, they say. We're far from home. This thing will be able to be concealed, and no one will know what we've done all this way out here. 75 miles is nothing to us in modern times, but it was an awful long way in those days. And so they feel they can do this terrible thing and get away with it. And they're scornful of him. Verse 19, behold, this dreamer cometh, this individual who dreams of supremacy. We'll see where his plans go and his ideas now. Come, therefore, let us slay him and cast him into some pit and speak of his destruction by a beast. Reuben, the oldest of the brothers, verse 21, he feels that he has to save his life. And you know the plot. He's going to suggest something else and then come back a little later and rescue the boy. But why doesn't he just try to persuade the brothers? Straight out, you can't do this. What, you can't do this to your brother? Reuben doesn't attempt to do that. Why not? Because he knows how savage these brothers are. He knows he cannot appeal to them. That will be wholly unsuccessful. He knows how rotten they are and how murderous their instincts are, and how impossible they will be to soften, and no hope of changing their minds. So the fact that Reuben himself has to resort to cunning in a feeble and abortive attempt to rescue Joseph from this murder shows something more of the hatred and the awfulness of the brothers. They are a no-good bunch, certainly. Anyway, verse 23, it came to pass when Joseph was come unto his brethren. Well, they just went for him. It doesn't say so, but they must have beaten him severely and punched him and then stripped his coat off him and cast him into a pit. The pit was empty, there was no water. And that 25th verse, you must have noticed it, with the blood running and the boy thrown into a pit he couldn't possibly get out of. I don't know why. Maybe it was a soft-sided pit. And the more you clamber out, the more the sand comes away in your hand. Maybe it was a hewn cistern with steep sides for the storage of water for travellers. They were certainly on a trade route, but it was dry, impossible to clamber out of. But as soon as they've thrown him in that, they eat. They have a good meal. So hard are their hearts. I don't think we particularly want to meet any of these young men. But when they see the Ishmaelites, who are also called Midianites, don't get concerned about that. The terms appear to be interchangeable in this passage. Some people go to great lengths to try to unravel what is an apparent contradiction, but it certainly wasn't a contradiction for the narrator here, who uses the terms equally. And when these Ishmaelites came from Gilead with all their cargo and the details are given, they decide to sell the boy. And Judah is the one, and he's no good, as we'll see, if we have time. He said unto his brethren, what profit is there if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? The trouble is, I think he meant exactly what he said. What are we going to gain out of that? Have we got tradesmen here, a caravan of tradespeople? We can not only get rid of him, but we can gain out of it at the same time. This is so cynical. He means exactly what he says, I think. Not what profit, what gain is there in murdering him, but what money shall we get if we just kill him or leave him to die? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. Let not our hand be upon him. Listen to this. For he is our brother and our flesh. Don't read any sympathy into that. It more or less is a way of saying we're entitled to sell him because he's one of us. So he's our property. We've every right to sell him. That's more what they mean than a sudden qualms about taking his life. So they sell him into slavery, and they get 20 pieces of silver for it. And you know the narrative of how Reuben returned and was very upset to see Joseph gone, but he soon went along with the story that they would dip the coat in goat's blood and take it to the father. And the father would be distraught, and although he isn't mentioned, I am quite sure Isaac would be distraught also. He's still alive, poor old man. He hears about Joseph, the godly one among the brothers, destroyed. The brothers didn't care about that. They didn't care about losing Joseph. They didn't care about bringing misery and distress upon Jacob and upon Isaac. And he hasn't been mourning many days. And verse 35, all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him. So cynical. I wonder what they said to him. But Jacob would not be comforted. But on the end of the chapter, there's that 36th verse. And the Midianites sold him into Egypt unto Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's and captain of the guard. And we have a chapter of the perfect type of Christ. Even up to this point, Jacob, without blemish. Of course, we know it's only a type. Joseph would have had his sins, but they're not recorded here. He seems to be an ideal son, and in that, he's a type of Christ. He reproves the sin of the family. And in that, he's a type of Christ who came preaching repentance and remission of sins. He's loved by the Father, and in that, he's a type of Christ. He's sent on a care mission to his brethren, And in that, he's a type of Christ. His death is plotted, and he's sold. And in all these respects, he typifies the perfect Saviour who would one day come. They want to kill the one who will ultimately be their deliverer. Oh, dear friends, it's obvious that the divine word is so structured as to provide us a type of Christ. And that is how our forebears all took it and all understood it. I'm coming back on this in a moment, but I want to just quickly touch on chapter 38. Because people ask of chapter 38, whatever is it doing here? We're right into the narrative on the history of Joseph, and we get this desperately rotten, evil conduct, which is recorded in chapter 38 concerning Judah. And the extraordinary thing is that it is through Judah that the promised seed will ultimately come. He is the privileged one. And right at the beginning, you're picking up old threads that run throughout the book of Genesis. Chapter 38, verse 1. It came to pass at that time, the time that Joseph is sold into Egypt, and the clock is ticking, and the years are passing, and meanwhile, this is what is happening to Judah, who will bear the promised seed and pass it on. And it came to pass at that time that Judah went down from his brethren, he left the household, and turned into a certain Adullamite, whose name was Hira. He goes right into the world. He leaves the homestead altogether, and he goes into a Canaanite region and town, and he makes a very good friend of Hira, the Adullamite, who is with him throughout this chapter, on and off. Obviously a rich Adullamite, and Judah also. And verse 2, Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite. Now he knows this is absolutely against the family tradition. He knows the trouble Esau was in for doing this with his father Isaac. He knows the sinfulness and how much against the plan of God this is. But he saw a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. That's not the daughter's name, that's her father's name. And he took her and went in unto her, and she conceived and bare a son, and he called his name Ur. She conceived again and bare another son, Onan, verse 4. And yet again she conceived, but this was after some time. And she conceived another son, Shelah, but he was a lot younger than the other two. And it's important to remember that. And Judah arranged a marriage for his firstborn son, and the bride's name, Canaanite wife, was Tamar. So he's gone right into the world, has Judah. He's abandoned everything. He's abandoned the faith. But not entirely. As you go through the chapter, you'll find this idea that you've got to honour the seed royal is still in his head. What a hypocrite! I am a special person. I bear the seed royal, the promised Saviour. And yet he's abandoned just about every other aspect of the faith. And he no longer goes to church, so to speak. He's out of the family circle altogether. Hypocrisy, the extent it can go to. As a hypocrite, you can keep some aspect of your faith, maybe, as in his case, 5%, and abandon 95%. So in passing, seems rather negative to be mentioning these things, but in passing, let's say, always be terrified of hypocrisy. Don't let it even begin to form where 5% of your faith you ignore and you hold on to 95%. You make that mistake and very soon it'll swing completely and you'll only be left with 5% and the devil will have you 95%, a complete hypocrite. This all started with Judah going down to Canaan and or to a Canaanite settlement and making a very good friend out of one of their leading men. And in no time, he belongs there and he lives there and he conducts himself according to their ways and their culture. He's gone. He's fallen completely. And this is the one who will carry on the seed royal. So it can happen. And hypocrisy creeps in. Is there a bit of hypocrisy in your life? Young man, you have a worldly girlfriend. Young woman, you have a worldly boyfriend. You don't tell your Christian friends. You worship. You may even teach Sunday school. You may do all manner of things. You're hypocrites. You're complete hypocrites. But you'll get worse. If you don't give it up in a year's time, you'll be much worse. There'll be more dishonesty and deceitfulness and deviousness in you, and more hypocrisy. And that's what's happened to Judah. What a beginning he had. Godly grandfather, great grandfather, great grandfather, godly father, exhibitions and demonstrations of the power of God and of faith, and now he's just a total hypocrite, hanging on to one shred of his faith. We must protect the godly seed, and never holding on to anything else. So beware of hypocrisy. It's what it can do to you. Well, I think you know the account of this chapter. I remember some years ago reading a very fine commentary on Genesis 38, and it handled all the details extremely well. And on the last page of chapter 38 in its comment, under the section suggested homiletics, there was a little, good writer, there was a little comment, this is impossible to preach from. At least the writer of the commentary was honest. But it isn't impossible to preach from, because there are very significant things here to show you the hypocrisy of Judah. But I'm too out of time to study them, and perhaps another time, but I must round up. The providence of God for Joseph. Grandfather, father, but violent, wicked, dishonest, malicious brothers. What a mixed situation. Has oracles, dreams from God, is despised for them, is beaten by his brothers, and sold into slavery. But what a training, when you think of it. I should have spoken more about this. He drew his knowledge from Israel, from Jacob, and from Isaac. When he was abandoned, God had so overruled that he was sold into slavery on a major trade route, right into Egypt. The believer is always in God's sight. It's not just Joseph, it's all of us. Always in God's sight, always in his hands. The great thing about Joseph is his humility and his faith, his trust in the Lord. And so the providence of God had mapped out for him a great future. And he maintained his principles in Egypt. His brothers had abandoned theirs even while in the house of God, but he maintained his. And their hidden lives. Judah, what he does with his prostitute, turns out to be his daughter-in-law, his conduct, the conduct of all of them in these two chapters, is awful. Best advantages, dreadful behavior. Joseph, the very opposite. Many trials, many problems, much hatred, much derision, and he holds his faith and his humility throughout. Oh, dear friends, we're going to enjoy looking, albeit briefly in the future, at the history of Joseph. Let's close this evening singing together that great hymn 566.